Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter. Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is a sound Ohio State fans know well. But have you ever thought about the individual sections and players, what it takes to create that whole sound? Consider what happens when you single out one instrument, the tuba. It sounds like this. This hour, we're going to learn about the tuba and give it its due and hear about the players who tell their stories through the instrument's unique sound. Joining us for this hour is author and journalist Sam Kionis to talk about his new book, The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass, Horn, Band, and Hard Work. Welcome to All Sides, Sam.
Thanks very much, Amy. Good to be back with you guys.
So listeners might remember your time on All Sides in the past. You've discussed your New York Times bestselling book from 2015, Dreamland, the true tale of America's opioid epidemic. In 2021, you followed up with The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. So I'm curious now, your new book is called The Perfect Tuba, and I'm curious about the journey that brought you to the topic of the tuba, because you were following the drugs here in Ohio, around the U.S., in Mexico. Why write a book about a tuba?
Yes, it's a great question, and there were times when I was wondering that myself, but really, it was because I became a journalist to really, you know, write about a lot of things. A lot of things interest me, and I didn't want to write about one thing only. I felt the two books, Dreamland and The Least of Us, really were pretty thorough. They were quite impactful as books. And what had happened was I just kind of got worn out on the topic of people, of addiction, which is really essentially people looking for happiness from something they buy, you know? And I just wanted to write about something more optimistic, more uplifting, people achieving something that through hard work, when I was at the LA Times, I was at the LA Times for 10 years. And when I was there, I wrote a story about the tuba in Mexican LA. And it's very popular, probably the most important instrument in Mexican Los Angeles. And after that, I began interviewing tuba players of all kinds and all styles. And I couldn't tell myself, I didn't know why exactly, except for that I felt that these were folks who were doing this because they loved it. And not for any great promise of fortune or fame. With tuba, there's very little of either. And so I knew as a journalist, though, that if you follow people whose main motivation is really because they just love doing it, perhaps because the instrument is showing them something about themselves, about what they can be, that you will one day find a lot of great stories. And so while I was doing Dreamland, while I was writing Dreamland and then speaking about the book all over the country, and then I was writing The Least of Us, I was at the same time doing occasional interviews with tuba players around the country, just kind of hitting them off when I was ever in their area. And so when The Least of Us was finished, I figured, okay, I think it's time to just focus on the tuba as a kind of a total break, a dramatic break from everything I'd written before, because that's what the beauty of journalism is. You write about stuff you don't know, but you're going to find out all about, and the tuba happened to be that for me.
At the end of the book, you acknowledge and thank your editor for his support. You say, quote, Admittedly, a strange project. So I sort of chuckled at picturing your book pitch when you went to your editor and said, hey, I want to write a book about tubas. How did that go?
Yes, it was a strange. And yet the weird thing was that I didn't really know what the book was yet when that happened. The Bloomsbury Press, which published the book, was very good about encouraging this project. I was saying, you know what, I'm going to try to see if I could find a book within this topic on the tuba that I've been doing. And by then I had in my computer a huge folder called Tuba with interviews and transcriptions and notes and some writing that I'd done and all this kind of stuff. And I said, I think it's time to try to figure out if I can do that. And they were quite encouraging, and they've been very good about pushing the book and so on and supporting me in all this. But I knew at the time it was a strange thing, because, you know, the truth is too, I don't play the tuba.
We should note that this is not your instrument.
No, I was never in marching band. I just thought that I wanted to, after writing about people enslaved to, a drug, I wanted to write about people who were creating something within themselves, for themselves, creating things with other people in collaboration with others, you know, and have that be a kind of the story rather than endless stories that are very grim. You cover heroin, you cover OxyContin, fentanyl, methamphetamine. The stories get really, really grim. And I wanted to write about people who were achieving something from within, very much more uplifting tales, but people who were doing so through hard work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like very easy to do this. These are people who really devoted themselves to this to this horn. And I guess after writing for years about addiction, I wanted to write about people who were finding themselves through hard work and collaboration.
The connection or the juxtaposition is not lost on me whenever you think about your books on the opioid crisis are about people basically dying, taking their last breath. But to play the tuba, the breath is everything you need. You have to take in so much air, and it requires so much of that. Is that a connection that you made at any point? I don't know if you want to.
Without a doubt, yes. It's a good point. It hit me midway through that even though I was trying to get away and not write about drugs at all, that this was what I was actually writing about was the opposite of addiction, right? Addiction is enslavement to a substance. The tuba and band, a larger context in band, is commitment, focus, discipline to creating something for yourselves with other people. It's also about liberating your own creativity, and I thought that was a very important thing. And that's where the air, the beautiful, precious column of air that you have to develop as a tuba player is really the life-giving force that we all need. Addiction is about shutting down that column of air. And it's a wonderful, it hit me as like this wonderful idea. Yes, what I'm writing about is what gives people life through the tuba. You can write about things like this through heroin, through OxyContin, through fentanyl. You are writing about what shuts down life and human creativity.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking this hour about the tuba, its musical evolution, and the players called to learn how to play it with veteran journalist and New York Times bestselling author Sam Kionis. And his new book is called The Perfect Tuba. So I want to go through some basics here, Sam. Can you describe the different types of tubas? There's a concert tuba, and tell me about the different types.
Well, the concert tuba is with the bell pointing up. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to carry it. And so years ago, the marching band maestro John Philip Sousa kind of designed the which you all know from the Ohio State Band and many other college bands as the tuba. It's actually sousaphone, which is one that you carry. It wraps around you. It's got the bell pointing forward. Mm-hmm. And then there's a euphonium, which is a smaller, it's called the tenor tuba. It's a smaller version. But the tuba is the youngest orchestral brass instrument. And so it's still being worked on, in a sense. It's still being, changes are still happening to the tuba, and the tubas themselves in different keys come in all sizes, like human beings. There's short and fat, there's tall and big, there's skinny. And so the tuba is a fascinating thing like that too, because it's still a little bit like a work in progress.
So the subtitle of your book is Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. So I wanted to ask about that, calling it a bass horn. What does that reference?
Well, the tuba is the bass. And here's the other thing. Without the tuba, you can't really have the band. In fact, if you think about it, the football depends on the tuba. Because football really relies for its, certainly college football, high school football, relies on this, you know, broadcasting, the great fame of the local football team or the college football team. You don't have a tuba, you cannot do that. The tuba is really the essential instrument without which you pretty much can't. And it's also the case that, by and large, in most orchestras, it's the tuba that's constantly playing. It's not often that the tubas play, get a rest. And so it's this essential instrument in propelling. And what you're finding, I think, too, is amazing. If you count the numbers of tubas in the marching bands at Division I schools these days, they've doubled in size. It's like you're thinking 24 to 40 tubas. I'm not sure how many Ohio State has. I think it's like 28 or 32. But other bands, Texas A&M has 44. I mean, it's like become almost, I don't want to get beyond myself here, but it feels to me very much like a tuba arms race, which you see in Division I college football, largely because I think a lot of more kids are in band. And the band means a lot now because of TV and all the rest. And so, but the tuba is the essential instrument and all that.
So you mentioned you're not a tuba player yourself, but you did get a chance to produce a sound out of one of the rarest tubas on the planet. Can you tell me about the Chicago Yorks? What they're known as. They're kind of like the tuba version of the Stradivarius violin, right?
Right. One of the things that kept me going as I began to as I was writing Dreamland and I was writing The Least of Us, in the back of my mind was this story that I thought was one of the most interesting I'd ever heard, which was in the entire tuba world, there are only two perfect tubas. And tuba players, and they're called the Yorks. They're made by the York Instrument Company out of Grand Rapids, Michigan, in the 1930s. That company later went bankrupt. So there's only two of them. And they're kind of custom made, and they are deemed to be like these holy grail type tubas. If you listen to tuba players talk about the Yorks that are now, they're now owned by the Chicago Symphony, but it's almost like this mystical, magical instrument, these instruments that just, you know, one guy said, if there was an instrument knew what you were going to play before you knew what you were going to play, that would be the instrument. And it's been this, various companies have tried to replicate these two Yorks, and really done a good job, but not a perfect job. And so they're still there at the Chicago Symphony. The Chicago Symphony tuba player, Gene Picorni, one day I went up there to view them. And really, I was only thinking of like viewing them like a museum piece. I didn't want to break them. Of course, you can't really break a tuba by touching it. But, you know, these are sturdy beasts. But he said, you want to play it. And, you know, first of all, what struck me was, and I finally got it on my lap, I said, of course, I'll try to play it. Never played a tuba in my life. And here I am playing these like legendary horns. Every tuba player in America would die to be in my seat at that moment. And I'm taking this thing. And first of all, the thing is gigantic. It's like having a linebacker sitting on your lap. It's not that heavy, but it takes up enormous amount of space. And then you put your lips to this thing. And you try to make that kind of thing. And oh my God, it was embarrassing. It was like making a sound. it felt a lot like when your stomach's grumbling because you haven't eaten for a while. It was so embarrassing. But, you know, it was the first time. But it was a remarkable thing because these horns are kind of the great Holy Grail for so many tuba players. I couldn't get over that. And I kept hearing about them during the time when I was writing about Dreamland, during the time when I was writing The Least of Us. I thought to myself, if I ever get into a book about the tuba, one of the stories I want to tease out and really find out and report out and see as much as find out as much as I can about is the story of those two perfect tubas. And so that's kind of what I called the book.
We are talking with author and journalist Sam Quiñones, and he is staying with us. And coming up, we're going to talk about some teachers who inspired generations of band students around the U.S., and we're going to get a little more into a few of the people that Sam highlights in his book. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. There was Arnold Jacobs in Chicago, John Weber in Harvey, Illinois, and Al Cortinas in tiny Roma, Texas. Three men, giants in their field, who loved the tuba and taught the fundamentals and watched their students flourish beyond what many, including the students themselves, believe they could accomplish. Such is the power of music and the power of teaching. Still with us is author and journalist Sam Quiñones, and his latest book is The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. Thanks again for being with us, Sam.
It's great to be with you. Thanks, Amy.
So the three men that I just mentioned all had incredible influence on the tuba world and over young people they taught and they guided. Can we start with Arnold Jacobs? You have three chapters in your book to him. And we were talking with Jennifer Hambrick. She's the midday host of our sister station, Classical 101, about your book. She shared that she once, while working in Chicago, she was a musician in Chicago, she sat in on a lesson with Arnold Jacobs that he was giving to another student, and she had vivid memories of his office filled with breathing devices, and she remembered how he talked about musicians as storytellers of sound. So can you give us a sense of this man, Arnold Jacobs, who he was and how he was significant to the field?
Sure. He was the tuba player for the Chicago Symphony for 44 years. He bought from a teacher one of the first of the two magical perfect Yorks, and then bought the second one many years later after he was already at the Chicago Symphony. So he was really a titan of tuba playing in America, at least certainly really the world, and part of creating that enormous brass sound that the Chicago Symphony was known for. But probably more important even than that, which is saying a lot, he was kind of a tuba hero to a lot of tuba players. Tuba players were looking to break away from the limitations of all these other people thought that what other people thought that the instrument could and could not do. And they were looking to become virtuosos themselves. And Arnold Jacobs was kind of like the hero of all this. But he also probably gained even more importance, I think, because he was one of the great music teachers of the 20th century in America. And he taught a lot of students, and we're not just tuba players, there were vocalists, there were other brass players and so on. It was almost like a Zen Buddhist monk approach to developing your wind, that precious breath of air that we were talking about. And then also he focused on what he called the song, meaning what your brain is, after much training, your brain is learning to, it wants to express through the horn. And all of this became part of his teaching. He taught hundreds of people. I can't imagine really how many students he had, but they were every day, all the time. I'm running into people who who had lessons from Arnold Jacobs. He taught at Northwestern for a while too. He was really a remarkable force in teaching people how to break from the limitations that they imposed on themselves or their teachers had imposed on them. And so he was really like kind of like the superhero of the tuba for much of the last century.
You describe tuba players as students who tend to be a bit of a loner, maybe a little bit nerdy, perhaps an outcast. Most of them are boys or young men. Does that hold true today, or is that a stereotype?
No, I think there's more and more girls getting into it. When the tuba was first taking off, when there was this time in tuba world when the idea was we need a tuba civil rights movement. We need a break from all the limitations that others impose on us. And Arnold Jacobs was kind of part of that. Creating a better quality tuba player was part of that. And I think what also began to happen with that is that more girls began to be tuba players. The thing is, though, that tuba players are kind of chosen early, because it depends on how can you actually carry the instrument at age 12 or 13. Or 14. So mostly it's boys doing it, and it's also, frankly, oftentimes boys at you might consider to be at the kind of the lower end of the social pecking order at every high school. What I loved about the tuba was that the tuba showed people what they were capable of, even though they didn't really know what they were doing, and they didn't start the tuba because they wanted to play it. Most people start the tuba because they are late for band class the first day of seventh grade, and there's no other instrument there
that's
available.
All that's
you know?
Left.
And so you got to do it that way. But what's fascinating about it is that they begin to play it and they begin to see that they're capable of something. And this is the beauty of the horn, it seems to me. It gives a lot of kids who have been told you can't do anything, it shows them what they can do, which is very much like the path the tuba has taken in the last 50, 60 years, which is that the tuba is only good for a few things. And then tuba players are generally breaking that, liberating their own creativity and showing that actually they're good for a whole lot more. After writing about the enslavement of addiction for 12 years and two books, I could tell you it was like, no pun intended, it was a huge breath of fresh air to be able to write about people who were finding themselves through the hard work they put in this instrument.
Let's talk about Bill Bell for a minute. He's credited with bringing the tuba to the mainstream. He released an album in 1957 featuring the tuba as the lead instrument. Before you tell us more about him, I wanted to play some audio from his album. So he does have an Ohio connection. He played in the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra from 1924 to 1937. Can you tell us a little bit more about Bill Bell?
Yeah, Bill Bell was fascinating. He was the kind of like the Jimi Hendrix of the tuba. And I say that because just as rock guitar players thought of the guitar very differently after Jimi Hendrix, they heard Jimi Hendrix, tuba players all over the country thought very differently about the possibilities of their horn after hearing that record. He was the new tubist for the New York Philharmonic and was quite a drinker, was quite a carouser, was kind of the king of the tuba scene in New York. It was very large in the 40s and 50s. And then he puts out this record, 1957, the same year that, Jerry Lee Lewis came up with A Whole Lot of Shaking Going On and Jailhouse Rock by Elvis Presley. This record rocked the tuba world the same the way that those records did. And I've talked to a number of guys who were very young when they first heard the Bill Bell and his tuba. Mm. He looks like an accountant. He's got black hair and black horn rimmed glasses, black jacket, white shirt, black tie, very square looking cat, but then kind of totally created a new idea. And all these kids who were kids at the time I later interviewed were saying, man, it blew my mind. It totally changed my impression of what the horn could do and therefore what I could do. And so he began The fascinating thing about Bill Bell is, I think, he began the liberation of creativity that I love to write about in this book. He began the liberation of the tuba with that record. He later went on to teach at Indiana University and then died in 1969. But his legacy is kind of the idea, like, we can do much more. And that record that you play a little bit of is really transcriptions of classical pieces that were mostly traditionally played by violin mm-hmm. and cello. And for tuba players to hear this and say, oh, I could play on the tuba what those people are playing on the cello? Oh my goodness, it is a mind-blowing thing, kind of like the way Jimi Hendrix blew a lot of rock guitar players' minds as well.
Well, and Bill Bell's legacy lives on in tuba Christmas concerts that take place each year here in Columbus and hundreds of places around the world. The first Tuba Christmas was organized by Harvey Phillips in 1974 to honor Bell, who was his tuba teacher. So here's a snippet of sound of a quartet of tubas performing in the WOSU studios back in December. It was produced by Classical 101 host Jennifer Hambrick and recorded by our audio engineer Dalton Jones. And, you know, I don't think of a tuba as an instrument of getting a solo, you know. So the fact that there's Tuba Christmas and that still exists, what does that mean to you?
Oh, it's exactly part of this whole process through which a relegated, confined horn finds its own freedom. And you mentioned Harvey Phillips. Harvey Phillips was, again, another one of the tuba titans of the 20th century. He taught at Indiana University after Bill Bell. He was important as well. He was a virtuoso, but important because he was like almost the Barnum Bailey of the P.T. Barnum of the tuba. He was constantly promoting the tuba and saying, we need to reach new levels. We need to break with old confinements that have been imposed upon us. He organized organized Tuba Woodstock, mm-hmm. which is the first congregation, the largest congregation of tuba players in the history of the instrument at Indiana University the year before the Tuba Christmas began. And it was just all these tuba players who had been all alone all over the country came together. There's 200-300 of these guys coming in on VW bugs and, you know, their horns and everything. And it was just this remarkable moment of seeing it. And it kind of created a national tuba consciousness, awareness that we are part of all this. We are all part of this tuba tribe. And it was not and then that led to other ideas. Harvey Phillips was nothing if not creative and big. He wanted big. He wanted big, splashy things. So he did the first Tuba Christmas in New York City, and then after that, it just spread. I think there's 300 plus cities where there's a Tuba Christmas, and it's the idea was we need to break from the ideas of what everybody else thinks we can and cannot do. And so playing Christmas carols, 50 to 100 to 300 in Akron, there's I think 400, 500 tuba players get together for Tuba Christmas. It's just breaking with the mold of what other people think is possible on this big beast of a horn.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with author and journalist Sam Quiñones about his new book, The Perfect Tuba. I wanted to jump back of some of the pioneers who made the tuba what it is today. Another one I mentioned earlier was John Weber. So he becomes a band director at a school in Harvey, Illinois in 1972. He was fresh out of college, a white man teaching black elementary and junior high school students. And he institutes a system known as the checkoff. So tell us about this system and how it was a game changer.
Well, this began, John began my my expansion of this book, not just about tuba players, but also about band directors, because I saw a similarity between tuba players who are really working hard to without any promise of wealth or fame, and band directors who are doing that on a band scale. And the first band director I really began to write about was John. He died last year, sadly. He was quite old. I did send him the manuscript of the book. He didn't see it published, finally, unfortunately. But he understood that he had a room full of talent that was going unrealized, and he also understood that all his students, most of his students anyway, could not afford music lessons. And the great band directors I began to focus on, this was always the case. They took kids who couldn't afford music lessons, could barely afford the instruments actually, and turned them into stellar bands, and then created, in John's case, they created a whole crew of what I call Weber kids, meaning his kids who went on to, a number of them went into music and are doing extraordinarily well, or teaching, but a lot of them just went into really productive, good, happy lives, I think. And it was John teaching them through band. And this is the pivotal thing about band. It's so important. It's hugely important in teaching music, but it's also very important in teaching the values that will sustain you through life. And he, you know, punctuality, discipline is a big one. Collaboration, again, is a big one as well. And this is where I first began to see the enormous importance of band in America, really. I mean, if you think about it, I don't know how you would ever count it, but my impression is that something like 20% of all Americans were once in a band in high school or junior high or college. And there you learn that what you learn in band is this essential stuff for having a successful life. John Weber was the first person that I saw actually do this. And I was able to, very lucky to be able to interview John several times before he passed, and able to kind of put together his story and the story of several of his Weber kids.
Yeah, an NPR affiliate, WBEZ in Chicago, gets a shout out in your book because of a performance from two of Weber's star students, Willie Clark and Eugene Campbell. And my producer, Aaron Rabinowitz, tried to find some audio from the 1986 performance of The Flight of the Bumblebees, but couldn't find it, unfortunately. But I just wanted to give you an idea of how tricky it is to play Flight of the Bumblebees, to picture how tricky it would be to play on the tuba. Here's what it sounds like when played by Steve of the Ulster Orchestra on YouTube. This particular piece of music, which you wouldn't picture being played on a tuba, you wrote, playing it on the tuba, the piece becomes a punishing sprint to see whether the player can get through it before stroking out.
Right. And what's weird is, this struck me as very strange, and no sooner did I begin to bring up that piece than I began to realize that part of the tuba's expansion beyond the confinement, beyond the enslavement of other people's ideas of what the tuba could actually do, is that so many tuba players now have learned to play Flight of the Bumblebee on the tuba. In fact, there's kind of almost a informal competition about how fast you can play it. I think the guy who composed it, Rimsky-Korsakov, was meant for it to be a minute and 20, but there have been several tuba players who've got it under a minute and so on. And so it's like it was this strange thing that began, but it was the Flight of the Bumblebee is also just emblematic of what tuba players are trying to do, to break away from, you know, it's a very punk rock kind of idea. I think it's like, we're going to do what we want to do, and we're not going to listen to you tell us that we can't do it, you know? And so sure enough, now you got tons of people and they're all over YouTube playing Flight of the Bumblebee on the tuba.
You also write about, it's a name I mentioned earlier, Al Cortinas. And you call him a visionary band leader. How did he transform? There was a tiny school band in Roma, Texas, and it became a top competitor. How did he transform this school?
Well, Al was a kind of a missionary for a band. It had changed his life as a young man. And he was a band director in a small school. The Rio Grande Valley is the valley that's the last 100 miles or so of the Rio Grande River, right across from Mexico. It's in Texas, and largely Hispanic, one of the poorest areas in the country. He was then hired to be band director in Roma, Texas, little town, 11,000 people. And the band was almost non-existent, or really there was, it was kind of a band, but it didn't really play very well, and no one really had any dreams of it playing better. And Al had this system that he put in place that the school board and the school superintendent backed to their great, great credit. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure they people understand how important it was what they did, but they created a system that allowed, again, these were kids who could not afford music lessons. The entire valley, really, where kids couldn't afford music lessons. So the band teachers became the major teachers. And Al convinced the school board that it needed to hire for the entire district, so 4th, 5th, 6th, all the way to 12th grade, teachers who would teach one instrument to all the kids who played that. And so one clarinet teacher, one trumpet teacher. And then that way, up to that point, they had three band teachers, and that was not enough. And so the band was nothing. And he convinced them to really invest in the band. And along the way, band became this thing. It became a way for poor kids to go to college, maybe to get a music scholarship, but often to just inculcate kind of in their own behavior the values of band, which is punctuality, discipline, focus, perseverance despite failure. And you began to see band become really cool. And within about 8 years, 7-8 years of Al Cortinas imposing this system, creating this system in the entire Roma school district, all of a sudden that band that was almost musically illiterate became a band that was now competing with the wealthiest schools in Texas, the suburban schools in Austin and Dallas-Fort Worth and whatnot. One band director says, you know, We're competing with the kids who get their lessons from the Symphonies of Texas. And this story just brings chills to my spine. It's a beautiful, beautiful story of kids finding what they're capable of. And then, you know, there's this thing about band that a band director's asked, how'd your band do this year? And he says, well, it's too soon to tell. Ask me in 10 years. And that's kind of what I found with the bands that came out of Roma. I talked to kids who are many years away from band, now adults and so on. And what they remember is it transformed my life. It made me understand the habits and the attitudes and all that allowed me to have a happy, a productive life. Even though I didn't go into music, I may be doing something in entirely different. And it was this also that made me understand, I'm going to write a book about the tuba, but I also think it needs to include, it needs to be about just as much about band directors. Band directors are out there working ungodly hours, really. It's crazy how much they work. And they are creating unbelievable value and values in the kids that they teach. You know, for a long time when I was touring, giving speeches about Dreamland and The Least of Us, people would ask me, how do I keep my kids away from drugs? And I never really had a real good answer.
You got to put them in the band. Yeah.
And now I say, well, you know, I don't know, but school band seems to do pretty well at that. Yeah. Might want to check that out. So
I have more than one friend who has told me that being in high school band was so important to them. It's the only reason they graduated high school. They kept their grades up so they could stay in the band. Yeah.
I don't know why any school superintendent would ever cut the budget for school band. You get better grade point average, you get higher GPAs, higher graduation rates, and you get more commitment and involvement in the school when you have a really solid band with good boosters and great teachers and kids who are committed and all that kind of stuff. It's one of these things that has never made much sense to me, much less sense to me now. But what the other thing is I've found is if you have conversation with people and you mention band, people will not come up to you and say, hi, my name's Joe. I was in band when I was in high school. But if you start talking about it, it's amazing how many people will tell you, oh my God, yeah, I was in band. It was the greatest thing I ever did. Or I loved part of it and then I didn't like it. But it was part of creating those values that sustain community. And I began to realize that this too was the opposite of addiction. What is addiction? It's isolation. It's I think a lot of our addiction problems grow from a shredding of community. And here you have an institution that is really one of the best in the world. We have some of the best musical education in the world in the United States in schools. And here you have a whole institution creating values of community, participation, perseverance, and all the things that are kind of opposite drug addiction.
We are going to continue our conversation with author and journalist Sam Quiñones about his latest book, The Perfect Tuba. Coming up, we're going to travel to New Orleans and to Mexico. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We've been talking this hour about all things tuba with journalist and author Sam Quiñones. His latest book is The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. Thanks again for being with us this hour, Sam.
My pleasure, Amy. Thank you.
So you tell the story of a man in New Orleans known as Tuba Fats, and I wanted to play a bit of music. It's from 2002, featuring Tuba Fats and his band, The Chosen Few. Listening to that clip, it definitely captures the sounds of New Orleans. But tell me more about Tuba Fats.
Right.
Yeah, he was born Anthony, is it Lasser?
No, Anthony Lason.
Lason, yeah.
Anthony Lason, he died in 2004. But in the interim, he became this kind of this legendary tuba player who never quite moved beyond New Orleans. There's a lot of brass bands that have become very famous, Dirty Dozen, Rebirth brass bands. They become very famous. They've toured Europe. They've toured all over the United States. Anthony Lason, Tuba Fats, just stayed in New Orleans. He was an enormous man, 6'4", 6'5", between 300 and 400 pounds, and was kind of like the leader of the outdoor music scene at Jackson Square in the French Quarter in New Orleans. He was a quiet, gentle giant of a fella, didn't seem terribly ambitious, wanted just to play for kids and play for people. When I went down to New Orleans, I realized I couldn't write a book about the tuba without including something from New Orleans. And I thought, well, I'm going to write a book, a story about, the anthropology of musical anthropology of how this horn can develop and blah, blah, blah. And that seemed, even when I said it to myself, that seemed like a boring story. Mm-hmm. And then when I get down there, just through some people that I met, I began to realize that the more...
Uh-oh. It looks like Sam froze, which we're going to have to see if maybe we can...
New Orleans kind of escaping.
Sorry, Sam. You froze for a second. So just back up. So, back up a couple of sentences. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. What I wanted to write, what I found that was a better story than any kind of story about the anthropology of how the music, how the tuba developed in New Orleans, which is itself an interesting stuff, but... For this book, it turned into a much better idea to write the story that I found, which is a love story. Mm-hmm. Love story between Tuba Fats and this woman, this very large woman, mm-hmm. with an enormous voice of singer named Linda Young, who showed up and just began singing in the square nearby. And these two very, very enormous people who needed each other for a variety of reasons I get into in the book, fell in love, and they had a seven-year Love Story got married, and they were really good for each other. They kind of complemented each other. And, you know, it was such a beautiful thing as a writer, I'm going to say. It just felt so right to me that you would write a love story, a tuba love story. It felt to me beautiful. And she died of cancer, very sadly, after they've been together about eight years. And Tuba Fats was never the same after that. He had an enormous number of friends. Everybody knew him. He'd been playing in the area for years and years, but he just kind of gradually disintegrated, and he died 7 years after Linda Young died. But I wanted to write about him because he, again, was a tuba player who was breaking all the molds. He was the leader of the band, which never had you had a tuba player be the leader of a band. Mm-hmm. That was a trumpet's job, right? You know, and he also was this kind of leader of the parades. The jazz parades were really, and the funerals were growing in immensely during these years. And he was kind of a leader of it because he was just gigantic. And then he had this huge sousaphone on top of him that allowed him to be the kind of the leader of the band and the parade. The largest funeral they've ever had for a tuba player was when Tuba Fats died in 2004.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the evolution of the tuba with author and journalist Sam Quiñones and his book, The Perfect Tuba. I wanted to touch on Mexico for a little bit and how the tuba is prominent in Mexico. It's also prominent in the Mexican section of Los Angeles. You write about a talented tuba maker named Zip Canstel, or is it Canstel?
Right.
Another colorful character. Can you tell me how his pursuit of the perfect tuba ended poorly for him and his company?
Well, Zig was the last of the independent instrument makers, and was very brave in all this. Created this company, Canstel Music, and they were making all kinds of brass. As the real estate bubble burst, and as imports from China kept up, it just took out a lot of his business. His last goal in his 80s, this guy was a gutsy dude. I always thought he just did what he wanted to do. Again, he was very punk rock in that way. Did what he wanted to do, and didn't matter what other people thought. He decided that he would try to replicate those beautiful York tubas, and I'm going to leave it to people to read what happens in the book, but it was more probably than he could have done in his 80s. And yet his story, again, was about someone who found enormous fulfillment from complete devotion. In his case, it was to brass instruments of all kinds, flugelhorns, trumpets, French horns, whatever, tubas. You know, the tuba was just a bit much. Particularly at that age in his life.
Well, then that leads me to going back to the title of your book, The Perfect Tuba. Does the title reference those York tubas you mentioned that are the perfect tubas, or does it have a deeper meaning for you?
Yeah, it's both. Mm-hmm. Both. I mean, I was really referring to, at first, to the, you know, the two York tubas that are these legendary tubas in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. But as time went on, I began to see the parallels or the opposites, I guess you might say, between what I was writing about in The Perfect Tuba and addiction that I was writing about in Dreamland and The Least of Us. And again, I began to think about all those parents who kept coming to me and asking me how to keep their kids away from drugs. And I said, well, now I tell them, the band is one place you might go. But for the book, I began to understand what was most important was that I began to say, maybe pushing your kids to find their own perfect tuba, meaning something that they are willing to put tons of effort in, not expecting great fame or fortune or any great applause, but just because they love it. And when you find, it could be anything. It doesn't have to be a horn, doesn't have to be in music at all. It could be anything. But when you find something that is your own perfect tuba, you can invest so much time and love into it. That is the best protection against drug addiction that I can actually think of. And so the end of the book is, you know, how do you, how do, How do parents do this? Well, what I'm telling people now is push your kids to find their own perfect tuba, something that they love so much that they can work hard at it and not regret it and just feel fulfilled. And worthy, and that they learn what they are capable of through investment of their own time and effort in whatever that perfect tuba is.
We only have a minute left. I'm sorry to ask you this with only a minute, but I know that writing this book was meant to be a respite for you from all the tough news you covered of the opioid crisis. I'm interested in your take now after you've had a bit of a break. Any final thoughts?
Oh, it was the most glorious thing I could have done. Oh my God, no, I realized midway, this is so exciting, this is beautiful. And what's all so true, again, I mean, I fell in love with this. I still don't play the tuba, but I still fell in love with it and the whole process of finding out stuff. Also, I came to understand something very strange that did not expect, and that is that the best sequel to a book about OxyContin and heroin, Dreamland, and another book about fentanyl and methamphetamine, The Least of Us, the best sequel to those two books is strangely a book about tuba players and band directors.
Well, we have been talking all about the tuba with author and journalist Sam Quiñones, and his latest book is The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. Thank you so much for your time today, Sam.
Oh, on the contrary, I mean, this has been wonderful. I so appreciate the interest.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I want to say thank you to producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz for producing the show today. You're listening to All Sides, and if you missed any part of today's show, listen back at our website, wosu.org/allsides, subscribe to our podcast, and every episode is available in the free WOSU mobile app. This is 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR's Morning Edition, which...
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.